Hello. I have a confession to make before I begin, and that is that about a week ago, coming back from a conference with 1,750 Muslims at the University of Toronto, I backed into a tree and knocked out my two lower front teeth. So if I lisp through this thing, that's my excuse.
You need someone to put the overheads on for you?
I'll do the slides after, now that we have.
That's the only sound we have.
Oh, okay. Can you hear all right? Because I'm used to talking to 13-year-old kids, so I can make this voice go a lot louder. I've been in Salt Lake a few times before, and I won't pretend any great knowledge of the LDS Church. However, I do know that Brigham Young was very, very eloquent about the need to stay away from government schooling. And it's difficult for me to understand what happened in between those eloquent writings and today. I was the keynote speaker at the Utah Home Education Conference, I guess about 6 years ago, and the chapter in the book over there on the table, Absolute Absolution, was absolutely written for this valley. It's been modified slightly, but the original work for it came from there. The talk today is broken into two parts, so you'll get to eat breakfast in about 16 minutes, and then we'll finish afterwards. It's called The Paradox of Extended Childhood. When I was a boy, my German granddad told me once that bored people are childish people, so if I wanted to grow up, I was never to whine about being bored, that the obligation to enlighten myself or amuse myself was nobody's responsibility but my own. And that makes sense when you think about it, and it's normally my own position on boredom. From Granddad's perspective, American secondary schools in the main can fairly be called laboratories of childishness, because by forcing mind-numbing routines of irrelevance on the young, they're certainly temples of exquisite boredom. To regard the institution of school as we have evolved it over the past 100 years as a breeder of childishness is disturbing. But to think that this might have been done for some purpose, for some rational reason, is simply mind-boggling. And yet that's going to be my thesis today, however crazy it sounds. The man from whom I first got wind of the idea that the real purposes of American schooling were not at all what ordinary people think they are, and that they include heavy-duty training in boredom, was James Bryant Conant, for 30 years the president of Harvard University and one of the most influential Americans of the 20th century. I'll get to what the other purposes of schooling besides boredom are in a little while, but first we're going to have to do some groundwork together. As significant as the mass boredom of young people is, the fact must be enlarged to include teacher boredom. Although teachers are loath to admit it in public, boredom is the common condition of school personnel. Their low energy, their dispirited speech, and often behind closed doors, their own whining is the giveaway. If you ask school kids why they feel bored, they always give the same few answers. They say the work is stupid, that it makes no sense, or that they already know it. They say they want to be doing something, not just sitting around. The teachers themselves don't seem to know much, and in any case, clearly aren't interested in what they teach. And when you ask teachers why they're bored, they say it's the kids' fault. They say the kids are rude, that they aren't interested in anything except grades. So how can a teacher be interested in them? It's a catch-22, you see. When you look at schools closely, you gradually become aware what childish places they are, how many kids and even teachers are held prisoners there in a childhood they would willingly have left long ago if they knew how, and if the institution had enabled them to escape. Before I continue, let me define my terms a bit further. Think of a continuum, sort of from childlike, which we expect young children to be, innocent, trusting, obedient, respectful, anxious to please, all the way across to childish. The palette of childishness includes selfishness, irresponsibility, boredom, envy, inconsiderate behavior, whining, and in general, a lack of emotional proportion and self-discipline. Childish people need to be attended to by adults. That's critical that you keep that in mind. It's an important clue to what's really going on. Childish people need to be attended to by adults. Now contrast that childish to childlike continuum with another familiar word that we're all aware of, youthful, which offers quite a positive window on human character. Youthful means adventurous, energetic, curious, resilient, indomitable, surprising, open to new experience. Very few schools in this country could possibly contain, let alone encourage, youthfulness. I hope you recognize the paradox in that. An institutional structure which finds itself compelled to suppress those very qualities which are universally acknowledged to be passports of success. Obviously, we're in the presence of some greater interest or interests which need protection against full human self-development on the part of too many. To explain rationally why we have the schools we do, put simply, they cannot be the way they are unless it serves some purpose or purposes. Remember, rationality and reasonableness are two very different things. Surely it isn't hard to make the case that our schools are unreasonable by discouraging the ingredients of youthfulness, but that's a far cry from proving them irrational. And you'll see what I mean as we proceed. Did you know that secondary school was hardly the only path to maturity until after World War II? Junior high school didn't even exist until well into the 20th century, and high school was only a minor part of society until the second quarter of the same century. You're at liberty to consider that progress, of course. But did you know that today, even today, in wealthy Switzerland, the wealthiest country per capita in the world, less than one kid in four goes beyond elementary school? You wouldn't be likely to know that because America's responsible newspapers, colleges, magazines, media outlets don't bother to tell you. That in itself is a paradox, isn't it? In Switzerland, there are many different avenues to maturity. That in itself is another paradox, isn't it? For most of our own history, most kids did not go to secondary school, yet the unschooled rose to be admirals like Admiral Farragut, inventors like Thomas Edison, captains of industry like Carnegie and Rockefeller, presidents like Washington and Lincoln, writers like Herman Melville, or scholars like Margaret Mead. People who reached age 13 weren't looked upon as children. Ariel Durant, who co-wrote the well-known History of the World, sold by the Book of the Month Club, which I own and I'll bet some people in this room own, also, was married at 13 to the man she stayed married to for more than 50 years. Would she really have been better off doing junior high school homework? Do you really believe that? If we had a successful system of education before we had universal forced schooling, as the examples of Lincoln, Carnegie, and Margaret Mead suggest, why were the training grounds in boredom we call forced schooling demanded as a replacement? It's a puzzle, but as we track childlike, childish, boring schools to their origins, we find ourselves back in time, 2 centuries, in the northern European nation of Prussia. By 1820, Prussia was teaching the world that schools could be training grounds for obedient political subjects. The mechanism to perform this magic was habit training, sensitizing children to be reflexively responsive to propaganda. How well this scheme worked to concentrate state power, the world was soon to learn in 3 titanic Prussian wars between 1871 and 1945. By the 1870s, Imperial Japan was converting to the Prussian system. And what we call today Japanese schools are in fact Prussian schools translated thousands of miles away. In the United States, it took 50 years longer. Beyond its war-enhancing ability, Prussian habit control schools served the emerging mass production business empires just coming into being as dominant factors in national economies. For example, in our own country, as Abraham Lincoln said to the Wisconsin Agricultural Association in 1859, almost everyone in the country had an independent livelihood. There were no giant factories or corporations as there were by those days in England and France and Germany, because people just worked long enough to get a little steak and then they cut out on their own. So huge companies in this country had 30 employees or 40 employees. But German psychology, and of course that's where the academic subject of psychology comes from, German psychology early on saw that school could condition children to be susceptible to any sort of authoritarian appeal, including the soft core authoritarianism of advertising and public relations. And if that were true, then Adam Smith's implacable law of supply and demand could be contradicted. It could be upset. It could be set aside. For if demand could be created for anything or any idea by subtle persuasion, then a managerial revolution was at hand, one which freed those in charge, including politicians, from a slavish inquiry and dependence upon public opinion. Public opinion could be what management made it. Thus, from its beginnings, founders of compulsory schooling aimed at collectivizing and socializing ordinary people through the inculcation of habits of dependency. In simpler terms, they worked to extend childhood far beyond its natural limits by arranging the removal of young people from home and neighborhood work surroundings and their placement with total strangers, false kin, as it were, unknown to the parents. And to deepen the bewildering estrangement, these strangers were themselves under the comprehensive direction of faraway strangers, completely hidden from public view, from whose decisions there would be no appeal. As I told you at the start, I first got wind of the real purposes of American schooling, which we're going to take up after you've had breakfast, from James Bryant Conant, president of Harvard for 30 years, an inner circle manager of the atomic bomb project during World War II. I mean, one of the top three or four men on the project. High commissioner of the American zone in occupied Germany afterwards, and a Mayflower descendant. Shortly after the war, Conant began to produce a stream of books about school and society. He's often credited with being single-handedly the legitimatizer of those enormous school plants, those anonymous warehouses of 2,000 to 5,000 students like Columbine in Littleton, Colorado. In a book published in 1949 bearing the title The Child, the Parent, and the State, Conant mentioned in passing, I'm reading through this extremely dull book, although slightly frightening, he mentioned in passing that a coup had given us modern schooling. Now, every hair on the back of my neck stood up, for here was the president of Harvard saying that we got our schools through a coup, and I had never heard that. That caught my attention. Anyone interested in the details of this coup, said Conant, should read a book called Principles of Secondary Education, printed in 1918, to find out what they were. This slight reference aroused my curiosity, and I began to hunt for that book, but for a long time, I mean a couple of years, I couldn't find a copy in any library, so I settled for looking up the author instead. And if you keep in mind that the president of Harvard was claiming in public print that this author, Alexander Inglis was his name, held the key to a coup which explains modern compulsion schooling, you'll be interested in Inglis' biography. It seems that he was descended from a prominent American family sympathetic to the British side in America's Revolution. One of his ancestors was rector of New York City's famous Trinity Church between 1765 and 1777. That was a parish representing the official state religion of Britain. And that particular Inglis had worked tirelessly to bring the same state religion to America and to make it the only way that you could advance anywhere in the United States or in America, for the colonies at the time. For reasons best known to himself, that Inglis fled from Washington's advancing army. Another Inglis wrote a refutation of common sense, Tom Paine's stirring call to revolution against England. And that Inglis was paid off by being named first Anglican Bishop of Nova Scotia in 1787, and still another relative was commanding general of the British forces at the Siege of Lucknow in India during the Sepoy Uprising in 1857. He was promoted to Major General for gallantry in the face of those rebellious Sepoy wretches. So, Dr. Conant had recommended a book by a man in a long line of descent from the attitudes of the British aristocracy as the key to the revolution that gave us schooling. And after breakfast, I want to tell you what Inglis said the six purposes of our schools are, but take this thought to breakfast with you, that the honor lecture in Harvard every year in education since 1925 is known as the Inglis Lecture. Thank you. I'll talk to you after breakfast. So, when you hear the six formal purposes of modern confinement schooling, as pronounced by this fellow Alexander Inglis, who the Harvard Honor Lecture is named after every year, you'll be glad that you and I went on that brief excursion before breakfast into his background, because his family certainly wasn't one of the groups happy about the winter of the American Revolution. School was intended on this continent exactly as it had been intended in northern Germany, to be a fifth column into the American libertarian tradition, a surgical incision in which the class-based management theories, those of England to be precise, would be inserted to interdict the liberty traditions. The method would be by infiltration into the minds of children out of sight of their parents. Theorists from Plato to Rousseau to Frederick of Prussia had known and taught that if children could be kept childish beyond nature's intention, if they could be held cloistered in a society of children without any real responsibilities except obedience, if their inner lives could be attenuated by removing the insights of history, literature, philosophy, economics, religion, music, and art, then a great enduring problem of supervision would be solved. For who can argue against the awesome fact that childish and childlike people are far easier to manage than critically trained, self-reliant ones? Now you're ready to hear Alexander Ingalls on the real purpose of schooling. There are six. The first function of schooling, these are all taken from a book called The Principles of Secondary Education, which is one of the truly unreadable books in human history. I finally found a copy in the New York University Rare Book Room. It's about 800 pages long. It's in very tiny print. And most of it seems to be simply an account of the schools that you and I are familiar with. What makes it interesting is those schools didn't exist when the book was written. But right about the middle of the book, Ingalls pauses and gives you the purposes of all this design. The first function of schooling is adjustive, and all the terms I'll use here are his. Some of the interpretations mine, but all the terms are Ingalls. So he says the first function of schooling is adjustive. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. Notice that this precludes critical judgment completely. Notice, too, that requiring obedience to stupid orders is a much better test of function one than following sensible orders ever could be, because if people follow sensible orders, you assume that their heads are on correctly. But if they follow stupid orders, then you know you have them. That explains some of the mysteries of schooling. Second is the diagnostic function. School is to determine each student's proper social role. The word proper is Ingalls's. Logging the evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records. You probably thought parents or the student himself or herself was going to decide that. Next comes the sorting function. School is to sort children by training individuals only so far as their likely destination in the social machine and not one step beyond. The fourth function is conformity. As much as possible, kids are to be made alike. This is not done from any passion for egalitarian ideals, but so their future behavior will be mathematically predictable in service to market research and government polling. Next comes the hygienic function. This has nothing to do with individual health, but a lot to do with the health of the race, at least as Inglis and Galton and Darwin saw it. Hygiene is a polite way of saying that school is expected to accelerate natural selection by tagging the unfit so clearly with adverse numbers, public insults, that they will drop out of the reproduction sweepstakes. And last is a fancy Latin word, the propaedeutic function, a fancy word meaning that a small fraction of lucky kids will quietly be taught to take over management of this continuing project, guardians of a population deliberately dumbed down and rendered childlike in order that government and economic life can be managed with a minimum of hassle. Now, it's one thing to say you're going to do all those things and another to actually do them. What, for instance, would the mechanism look like which could reduce people to a state where they would willingly accept such dispositions? While Britain and Germany had conditioned their own populations for centuries to accept paternalistic direction from the political state, it hadn't happened here, and a project of this magnitude could not simply be rammed down citizens' throats. They would have to be taught to actually welcome it, increment by increment. If at any point public outrage got too loud, the scheme's managers would have to know enough to retract it a bit and wait until under cover of some national emergency like war or other civil unrest, it could be sent racing forward while people were looking elsewhere. That's exactly how the formidable American ability to read and argue was deconstructed under the drums and tramplings of World War II. The plan, simplified mightily for purposes of this talk, called for the infantilization of America, the gradual dumbing down, the gradual demoralization, the slow, steady removal of critical responsibilities from families and their transfer to bureaucrats. What I'm talking about is a radical extension of childhood, principally through schooling at first, but in time through every institution, including and especially through popular mass entertainment, which removed the necessity to entertain oneself while at the same time it struck minds at their most accessible. But once again, I need to reiterate that childishness is not an objectionable quality to management, but rather its very justification for being. Childish people are unable to offer effective resistance. They may whine, complain, even shoot one another, but they have no idea how things work. Childish people, for all the noise they make, are nearly helpless. Eventually, they fall into line because they have no other choice. They lack inner resources to be self-sustaining. Through the second half of the 19th century, beginning in the North German states of Prussia, Saxony, and Hanover, a science of making young people childish grew up. It was studied by certain prominent Americans like Horace Mann, William Torrey Harris, who was our first National Commissioner of Education, the Peabody family, J.P. Morgan, and by others who envied the control it offered to management. They wanted that control for themselves. With the rise of the centralized corporate economy, a quarter century after the Civil War, another overriding reason to place the population under tight management arose. But before I tell you about that one, we need to get a few red herrings out of the way. At the same time that this was happening, other groups besides big businessmen and political leaders had reasons to advocate against intellectual education and education in personal competence too. Utopian socialists like Robert Owen and J. John Ruskin thought that through an endless childhood, an agrarian utopia could eventually be achieved. The evolutionary crowd like Darwin, Galton, and Herbert Spencer thought that most of us were biologically retarded and could not grow up. It would only make trouble to try. Scientific historians like Hegel and Herder and Marx thought that by keeping people dumb and incomplete, history itself could finally be controlled and guided to a conclusion. There were others too, but we needn't review them all here. Suffice it to say that while there were plenty of other interests who wanted the public childish, none had the resources of corporations to sustain a campaign in that direction. For a long time, it only required a little corporate financing done behind the scenes to allow an army of innocent academic and philosophical screwballs to do the corporate government bidding unknowingly, thinking they were riding their own hobby horses. And that is the explanation for the control of American education by about a dozen corporate foundations, beginning with Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford. I personally was put on the trail of radically extended childhood, paid for by big business and government, by reading the works of Elwood Cubberley, a close friend of Dr. Conan at Harvard, and he was Alexander Inglis's partner at Houghton Mifflin, where he edited the elementary school series. That publisher of books monopolized for the first two decades of the 20th century, while Inglis managed the secondary school series of books. Cubberley was also dean of teacher education at Stanford and head of a thing called the Education Trust, a shadowy cabal of well-situated academics nationwide who controlled every major administrative post in America by 1918, and if you ask me, still do, although I have no evidence of that. If you ever want to read about that employment coup, where all the administrative jobs in the United States were controlled out of one center, a nice account exists in David Tyack's book, Managers of Virtue. And while I'm not here to sell Mr. Tyack's books, I think it's interesting that Tyack was a highly placed official in the Massachusetts Education Department, so he could hardly be called a radical or a conspiracy theorist. In 1906, Cubberley had written that in the new schools coming, children were to be shaped and fashioned like nails, and specifications were to come from business and government in that order. If any of you would like to actually see those words, you need to get your local librarian to request Elwood Cubberley's PhD thesis at Columbia Teachers College in New York City, and it will in due time come. I can guarantee you there are lots of other surprises. Specifications, of course, were a term for the outcomes desired. How those outcomes were to be reached was and is up to the academics and bureaucrats who work for the policy people. Management by objectives, it's called in business. A few years later, in 1919, Cubberley wrote again that childhood had been deliberately extended by 4 years because a combination of powerful interests was demanding this. That's taken from somewhere around page 700 in his History of American Education, which very few people ever read. The trick was pulled off by denying children association with the adult world. I mean, anyone here, and I'll bet half of you, have read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, and the other half who haven't should read it immediately. At the age of 12, Franklin is working a 60-hour week, and he's putting himself in his spare time through an academic course that I guarantee you Yale doesn't require of its students. And furthermore, his friends were doing the same thing. That was the United States in 1750. So the trick was pulled off by denying children association with the adult world and with real responsibility through comprehensive confinement schooling, which created a separate world of children apart from social and economic reality. There, the little human resources could be held until summoned. It isn't hard to see that the interest most directly served by delaying personal sovereignty is something I think I can fairly call the managerial outlook. Scientific management and human independence are mutually contradictory forms. Once professionalized, management finds it tempting to argue that neither children nor parents can be trusted, that the only sensible way to handle growing up is through expert goal setting and professional interventions at public expense. Excuse me. It's time we faced that scientific management is never served by allowing children to grow up, even to grow whole. Its tutelage is justified intellectually by academic disciplines like psychology, sociology, anthropology, evolutionary biology, even by military science. Each contends in its own way that growing up is impossible for most of us. All these academic disciplines grew from government or corporate underwriting, along with the statistical techniques which lend them their credibility. The philosophical momentum of scientific managerialism in the West was only effectively balked by one thing, by the theology of Christianity, which expressly forbids the faithful to duck personal responsibility. Recall that all these other managerial systems say, just do what you're told, don't rock the boat, and the enterprise will work well. Christianity establishes the road to salvation as a lonely, personal one. Thus, Western religious thinking itself had to become a prime target of schooling. From a pedagogical perspective, Christianity was so implacably contrarian, it had to be systematically marginalized. Somewhat over 100 years ago, higher academic voices in America set up a litany which communicated this: we will remain children forever, always in need of supervision and regulation. That was the identical message that Prussians had heard a century before. One recent piece of evidence that our listeners listened to the voices is found in a press conference held by Vice President Gore's wife just before the election of 2000, and this was broadcast to the nation. In that press conference, she declared that 55% of the American population are mentally disturbed and in need of therapy. But Mrs. Gore is only one of a host of commentators urging that we be kept under closer and closer surveillance. When speaking to this question of general irresponsibility, observe how very convenient and useful it is that American classrooms are workshops of rudeness, rowdiness, and absolute danger. How better to instruct coming generations that their only hope of safety lies in expert ministrations. The end of the 20th century, about 100,000 American school children were being barcoded in an experiment to track their passage and see to it that each boy and girl was always where someone else thought they belonged. Everything in its place, a place for everything. The profound change in the American bargain with its young, the change that dumbing them down and demoralizing them brought about, was not the result of popular demand, nor was it caused by prominent socialists like John Dewey, who are often blamed. And I'm not saying that Dewey wouldn't have welcomed it. I'm simply saying that Dewey had little influence on anybody. The transformation was an undertaking of industrial titans like Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, Vincent Astor, Commodore Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, and a few others. The private tax-exempt foundations and elite private boarding schools of these men continue their work to this day, though by now augmented mightily by a government and academic machine largely of their own creation. It is not an accident that John Dewey's first major employer at the University of Chicago was John D. Rockefeller, and his second major employer at Columbia Teachers College was the very same John D. Rockefeller's son. Remember, these men were only interested in outcomes. I'm not suggesting they micromanaged anything. This is the outcome. Here's the money. Go do it if you know what's good for you. They were only interested in outcomes. They left details to underlings like Henry Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski. And what is that work? One way to understand it is to see it as a systematic recreation of the class-based, expert-driven managerial society of England, only this time based in supposedly objective scientific principles. Why would economic leaders committed to Adam Smith's capitalistic principles veer in this decidedly socialistic direction? Fortunately, they tell us in their own essays, memoirs, letters, and occasional writings. Carnegie and Rockefeller, for instance, both despised competition, and they frequently stated that publicly. They thought it was irrational. As purely rational thinkers, they worked with might and main to stamp out competition, replacing it with a planetary form of government intended to resemble the British Empire and its state church corporate theology. By the last quarter of the 19th century, coal and oil promised unlimited energy, and coupled with mass production machinery, it seemed that an industrial utopia was actually within reach, but only if society could be made susceptible to a degree of scientific management beyond historical precedent. Personal liberty and conventional morality would have to be surrendered if this promise were to be realized. Indeed, as I told you earlier, even the law of supply and demand must be forced to give way. But how to get rid of the libertarian American past? Put yourself in the position of these visionary industrialists struggling to socialize the majority into dependence on central management. The authority of the political state has to replace the authority of the family, tradition, and religion. It was a huge task. There was nowhere else to start but with children. So, drawing on the method pioneered in Prussia, the quick arrival of young Americans at responsible maturity had to be ended. Financial capital demanded it, and this is a major point. Why would anyone make the continuous huge investments that mass production machinery called for, machinery that was certain to obsolete itself quickly, requiring replacement, unless profit could be guaranteed and markets assured? Unless this could be done, capital would not be forthcoming. Now, assuring markets is an old game. Britain had been doing it for centuries. Competition can be muted through trust formation, government regulation, government subsidies which stack the market deck, and in other ways unknown to the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. But not so easy was convincing our uniquely productive population to give up its traditional yearning for independent livelihoods. The majority had to be retrained to think of itself as employees and as consumers instead of producers. Otherwise, the perils of overproduction would frighten away the investments that centralized industrial growth depends upon. And so mass schooling of a compulsory nature was given teeth between 1905 and 1915. I mean, the police were sent to bring children to school. No longer charged with fashioning good people or good citizens, now it was directed, as it had been in Germany, to the inculcation of habits, appetites, attitudes, and fears useful to management. That's all you need to know to understand standardized testing, which correlates with nothing at all, even what it advertises that it's supposed to be measuring. There have been 84 major studies desperately attempting to show that standardized tests correlate with effective performance. They do not, except on one thing, and that is on your grade on the next standardized test. And I would suggest to those of you who are skeptical of that, that if you knew anyone in your life that actually made a major personnel decision on the basis of a standardized test score, you wouldn't even talk to the person anymore. They would clearly have defined themselves as so moronic. George Bush's standardized test scores at Yale are 550 in reading. 550. That's a respectable mediocrity, but let me tell you that the Democratic Party intellectual Bill Bradley had only a 480 and graduated from Princeton. And Paul Wellstone together had an 800, which wouldn't qualify him for admission into any American university except one desperate for tuition. And if people can be senators and governors and representatives and presidents with those scores, count on it, you can be anything else. Keep in mind, this scheme was never intended to be destructive, just the reverse. By converting Americans into specialized economic and social functions, into incompletely human beings, this nation eventually achieved the most reliable domestic market in the world. And several years ago, in the official journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, the publisher of Newsweek boasted that we had the only reliable domestic market in the world because of the peculiar habit of American workers not to care about anything but their paycheck and to define the meaning of their lives by what they bought. He was boasting that it would take 100 years for another country to teach its citizenry to think that way. The human mutilations of schooling are a trade-off for this prosperity. Comfort and security are achieved at the price of personal sovereignty and wholeness. That's what makes extended childhood a paradox. Give it up and society will enter a zone of great turbulence, the resolution of which nobody can predict. And James Brown Conant, in the book I cited earlier in this talk, said, you would have to be mad, even if you didn't like this thing, to turn the clock back to where people had independent livelihoods. He meant that there is no easy way to do that without this zone of turbulence. Once you see its logic, the mechanisms of forced schooling are fairly simple to avoid. Well-schooled children are trained to reflexively obey strangers' commands and to continually seek the judgments of strangers. Later on, after school was done, advertising and advocacy journalism, paid for by advertisers, slip easily into the role of school teacher. Well-schooled people have a low threshold of boredom. They need constant novelty to feel alive. With only the flimsiest inner life, they must stay in touch with official voices through television, radio, internet, cell phone, commercial music, and other commercial entertainments, pop journalism, and shallow friendships on a regular basis. They cannot sit still without their minds wandering off to the commercial world or to the stock market. Changing classes at short intervals is a drill to prepare kids for changing associates, domiciles, mates, and possessions in dizzying and eternal profusion. A climate of low-level dissatisfaction is the very air that centralized mass production economies must breathe, and therefore it is practiced in school. Well-schooled people must be poorly trained in history, philosophy, economics, literature, poetry, music, art, theology, in anything known to develop a personal inner life. Well-schooled people need lifelong tutelage, cradle-to-grave schooling to make any sense of their days. Mass entertainment and mass journalism provides that tutelage long after school is done. And now I'm going to bring this talk to a close, and I'll summarize. Over a century ago, great industrialists, with the help of academics and politicians and socialist kooks, set out to rewrite the laws of supply and demand. They knew that if centralized producers learned to create demand for whatever could be produced most efficiently, the moral world could be turned upside down and those dogs at the top could bark there forever. The problem of succession, which had doomed Rome and every other empire in human history, would finally have found its solution. Thus, schoolrooms became laboratories of experimentation on young minds. They were research centers of scientific management. To be quit of the school nightmare demands first that we wake up to what school has evolved into, a servant of big government and big business. If you seek a change in schooling, you first have to repudiate that fatal belief that if only government could be given more control, then all would sort itself out. What to do about this personally? Learn to be a saboteur. Throw sand in the gears of this machine whenever you can. There is no way to reform it. It does exactly what it was designed to do. Recognize the paradox of extended childhood, the blessings it brings to central management, the prosperity it invests the economy with, by converting spirits destined for independence into whining, greedy, bored children who define themselves by what they consume. That prize is too contemptible to be worth the cost. When you next find yourself appalled by the infantile and irresponsible behavior you see all around you, think of school as its forge and try to do something about it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. God bless. If David tells me that there's time, I have five slides I'd like to show you. Actually, I have about 100, but I'll show you five of them. The first slide is Big Brother High. You recall I told you that 100,000 American school kids are being barcoded. And here is one kid's sarcastic rejoinder to being barcoded. But count on the fact that if this works with a small group, that you can expect to see it offered as a safety measure necessary in all the schools. The second slide I'd like you to see, are some crayons that were given out widely on the East Coast by benevolent corporations, and they were absolutely free. If you turn them sideways so the names can be seen. I have the same problem exactly after. There they are. It's a Benetton green and Coca-Cola red. Now imagine how effective. These things don't cost two pennies to put in the hands of a kid, and they must last for quite a number of days there. This is really effective advertising for a very small cost. The third slide I'd like you to see is how the television channel, which one is it? Well, it'll be marked on this. How it actually, Nickelodeon, which I, as I understand it, I've never seen, is it makes movies for kids. It says, a nation of kids and they drive purchases. 62% of all sport utility vehicles, it's the kids influence the family to buy them. So Nickelodeon, which seems to be a great service to children, in fact, takes the children's attention and resells it to sport utility van companies. The fourth is from your neighboring state. I don't know if it's a neighboring state, but it's not too far away, of Minnesota. Is that nearby? And I apologize to the mixed company here, but I'm going to show a urinal, and if you could move it just a little to the right there, you'll see Channel One and a number of other ads. Now, is that point of purchase or what? But they didn't do that for fun, I don't think. Okay, and finally, could you show the kid with tubes coming out of his ears? You'll see tubes. You won't be able to read that on them. They're Slim Jim packages. So if you just drop it, so that's it. Now, that boy, I've shown this three times, and most people think that boy is 13 or 14 years old, which was the group, the age group that I worked with all my adult life. And there he is doing something harmless and innocent right at 13 or 14. If you look at that boy and try to imagine that Admiral Farragut was in command of a warship sailing from Peru to Boston at the age of 13, I think, or that Thomas Edison had a newspaper business out in Michigan, 1,000 miles from his home, in which he was making about four times as much as a skilled working man selling news about the Civil War, because the train he worked on as a porter had a telegraph. And then you look at Benjamin Franklin working a 60-hour week at the age of 12 and doing this magnificent intellectual work in his spare time, so magnificent that he is the reason that we got underwriting for the American Revolution from the French. It was Franklin's ability with, no one ever said the French are nice to people who mispronounce their language. And yet Franklin was over there for years talking them out of money to underwrite the revolution. Some historians say the reason the French Revolution occurred is that Franklin bankrupted France, borrowed a lot. Anyway, if you could just see that out of one of your eyes as a horrible sight, that someone who in most of human history would have been a young man playing with Slim Jim tubes because he has nothing better to do, then we'll be on the same page. Okay, there's an interest. I guess you've seen Elian Gonzalez, but you haven't seen him doing ads for Tommy Hilfiger some expensive jeans company. Oh, he doesn't look too happy in that picture, but nevertheless, that's our well, okay. So we start them early, don't we? Thank you very much. Thank you. I guess I used up the time for questions.
Teacher of the Year there twice. Must have been a long time ago, huh?
The same way, I must tell you that in my hometown that I grew up, there is in fact, it's the center of a Mormon religion that isn't this one. They just didn't go west with Joseph Smith. And in Monongahela, there's a national convention once a year. I guess they don't have all that many members, but they have enough there. New York State is divided between New York City and the other big cities in the state and upstate New York, which is most of New York State. Upstate New York is very much like the message I brought to you today. And upstate New York happens to have most of the votes for New York City and New York State Teacher of the Year. The idea, I think, I'm only guessing, but the idea of rubbing New York City's face in it by picking me as a New York City Teacher of the Year, I think was too tempting for those guys to overlook. Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'll let... Yes, sir.
Yes, LDS, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as opposed to taking what we bring into our witness as we call
it. It's a complex question that deals with original sin, and if the speaker is correct, the LDS's rejection of the concept of original sin... I'm not trying to duck the question. It's a little hard to answer one or two sentences, but I will tell you this, that my entire talk before the Homeschooling Association of Utah 6 years ago was in fact about original sin and what its effect is in a positive sense. I realize that might be very hard to take even if you weren't an LDS audience, but the chapter in my book, Absolute Absolution, deals with that aspect of Christianity. I think original sin is most closely associated with the congregational religion, which is those tall, white, spired churches you see all over New England, and with the Presbyterians, who my wife is a solid, original, conservative Presbyterian member. But if you want to see more about that, I mean, original sin, what we don't understand is that ideas, I'm quoting a title of a book that everybody ought to read, ideas have consequences. And the idea that people are born seriously flawed and cannot recover from those flaws clearly can be used in conjunction with the idea of election, that only some people are selected for salvation, that the two working in tandem with each other can be a very destructive idea. I chose myself, I was asked to speak 3 years ago to follow the Dalai Lama at a conference out in Colorado. And I said, I will come if I can speak for Christianity. And even though my hosts were certainly about as close to being anti-Christian as possible to be, they said I could. And I spoke about the positive side of the idea of original sin, that you never will overcome, you can never overcome these penalties that are assigned in Genesis because of what's been called original sin. But by struggling against them rather than looking for some pill or some medicine, let me just tell you what some of those penalties are. There are only four. I probably can remember three of them offhand. One was that you had to work for your living. I mean, in Eden, nobody had to work. I mean, everything was there. You had to work for your living. You had to sweat for your bread. Well, now you can avoid that by having other people do your work and collecting the fruits of their labor. You can do it. There are lots of ways to avoid that. But avoiding work seems to me is the shortest road to perdition. That work is one of the glories of being alive. It's a central glory of being alive, is work. And the harder you work, it seems to me, the happier you are. I grew up in western Pennsylvania, and I was surrounded by people who either worked in coal mines or steel mills. I mean, I guess I might have run across an executive type once in a while, but most of the people I associated with worked harder than slaves worked. Let me tell you, they were the finest, finest people. I mean, whatever's left of me that's good is there. They were my teachers. So that's one of the penalties of original sin. One of the penalties is that you have to grow old and die. Now, we all know people who devote most of their life to preventing themselves from growing old and dying, and yet they all grow old and die anyway. It's just they spend, you know, most of their resources in avoiding those things. One of the penalties was, remember in Eden, that there was nothing wrong at all except one thing. That is, you couldn't make a mistake if you stayed away from that tree. Well, one of the penalties was that every single one of our actions now would be morally charged. And you would always be responsible for making the wrong moral choice, but you'd have to make thousands of these choices. Well, there are certainly lots of people who avoid doing that. They say what works is right. I'm doing okay. I don't see anything wrong with how I got here. So I think that it's like most great human truths, I believe. It has this huge dialectic about it. It depends what you draw from it. I would not deny, and certainly if I'm with a group that theologically rejects original sin, I would not deny that enormous harm has been done in the name of that. But I would say that there's also a secret to a great life locked up there. So there I said that. this lady, I believe, had her hand up first, sir, and then.
This one more.
Okay. I'll try to be shorter then. Call. Yes, ma'am.
My question will be easier to answer. And that, just, do you have children and how have they been raised?
Well, I came to whatever I know, unfortunately, very, very slowly. So I have two children. They're both well along in years now, and I'm well along in years, and I made, I think, large mistakes. They were honest mistakes in the sense that I listened to everything I was told. And for example, one of the large mistakes I made, and I know that I'm in the right audience for this, is that I grew up at a time when all officialdom was saying that two children was the limit. That was it. Two was the limit. That was a good family. Larger families than that got poor attention, and the kids were neglected, and they fought against each other, and anyway, it wasn't fair to the planet. I must say that in between believing that, which probably I believed in my early 20s when I was married, and now when I'm an old man, it's just hooey. It's exactly the reverse of the truth. The large families have warmed my heart. They warm everybody's heart. If I know that somebody came from a large family, I know all sorts of good things about them. And I don't mean to say there aren't good small families too, but it just seems to me that that community of love, you know, is the genius institution. I mean, I made lots of mistakes. To judge children by their grades in school is idiocy. I mean, you've got your eyes, your ears, your heart. You can judge people the way you judge whether you got a good haircut or not. You look in the mirror. You don't ask the guy to see his grades in barber college. You know, and what if he got A's and there's a stripe down the middle of your head? Yes, sir. I think that's why I'm here.
At the beginning, you mentioned that you don't know much about the LDS religion. Wouldn't you like to know more?
I will know more. I will know more. I'm learning more for the rest of the day here. And I also have some books that were given to me that are my homework for. And they're from an LDS perspective on schooling. And darn it, I've read a few of Brigham Young's essays anyway.
Let us know when you get baptized.
Just Laurie up back. Ask it, Laurie.
Yeah.
Oh my, I think I'm being set up here. But over the years, I've now been traveling and speaking for about 11 years, and I started out knowing nothing at all about homeschooling at all. I mean, nothing at all about homeschooling, other than it's self-defining, isn't it? There. Well, it isn't. I'm so transported with what I've seen in 50 American states and in about three foreign countries that homeschoolers are doing. They all do it a different way. It's such a magnificent laboratory, I think, of how to be and how to be human and also how to develop in any direction you want to develop, that I, when I'm hired, as I am occasionally by school superintendents, I tell them, you're absolutely mad to spend your money getting advice from experts from Washington when you could secretly hire a group of homeschoolers, bring them in here, and your hand would fall off before you'd written down all the great ideas they have. So while I find other forms of schooling much more attractive than the government institutional brand, I must say my own heart is, if I could do it again, my kids would be homeschooled, and I can tell you this, my grandkids are homeschooled. Yes, yes, ma'am. Oh, I didn't know that. I'm glad to know that. One simple way to see this great divide is a matter of trust. The earlier speakers mentioned, where is the trust? You know, God gave us all that we need. And it didn't, I don't think, intend to see it subordinated to kings or their secular equivalents. There, I found as a school teacher, and mind you, I was teaching out of my own culture and out of my own region, and I had a different accent than the kids, but I found that the extent to which I trusted them, I held their feet to the fire, but I trusted them, I was seldom disappointed. And the extent to which I kept all the reins of control in my hands, I was always disappointed. So I was convinced almost unwittingly that people have God-given power to right themselves, to do good, to do great things. And I, even though I'm at the end of my life, I would recommend anyone in the beginning or in the middle to keep that in mind. Trust your kids. Trust each other. You know, I've traveled around the country for, as I say, 10 years, close to 800 places in all 50 states. And never once when I set books out on a table did I sit behind the table. I always put a pot with a little sign with a price. I said, honor system. I don't think in those 10 years in 50 states, I don't think six books have vanished. I mean, maybe none have vanished. So few have vanished that I have a whole different outlook on people. The earlier speaker said there's two countries. There's the country that Washington talks about in official, and then there's the real country. Well, more of us live in the real country than we're allowed to understand. There. Thank you.